We live in a day when newspapers are fighting for survival, and so respectable papers are sometimes look a little bit like the tabloids. And Friday's front page headline in the Chicago Tribune was just such a headline. In black and red, it screamed out the words, "He killed 14 people. He got 12 years." And the story described the culmination of the Family Secrets Trial, as it's become known. Jeff Cohen's byline, under his byline, it ran like this. "It was a judgment day like none Chicago has ever seen. Mob hitman Nicholas Calabrese, who admittedly took the lives of 14 people, stood before a judge Thursday as the only member of the Chicago outfit ever to testify against his superiors. His cooperation solved some of the Chicago area's most notorious gangland crimes and sent three mob leaders to prison for life. Weighing Calabrese's terrible crimes against his unprecedented testimony in the Family Secrets Trial, a federal judge sentenced him to just 12 years and 4 months behind bars, leaving relatives of Calabrese's many victims outraged and distraught. Making the sentence even harder to swallow is the likelihood that Calabrese, 66 years old, will be released from prison in as little as 4 years. That's less than a year for every person whose life he took," one victim's father said. "A widow collapsed in the courtroom and had to be carried out on a stretcher." It hasn't been that many days that there were other glaring headlines from the newspaper voicing outrage over the paying of bonuses, $165 million in bonuses, to employees of AIG, the insurance firm that was bailed out by the federal government, or maybe I should say bailed out by you and me and by our children and our children's children, to the tune of $170 billion. There were a lot of angry headlines, a lot of outraged people about those bonuses. And it hasn't been that many weeks since the Bernie Madoff story, in which this so-called investor took $50 billion of other people's money and created for them a fortune on paper while building a very real fortune for himself. Wealthy people, charities, nonprofit groups, it didn't matter. Hundreds of victims were bilked of their savings and their investments. That there were more angry people in that courtroom without any chance of repayment, really no opportunity for any restitution, powerless to take anything from Madoff except his days as a free man, which was not enough for those who had lost everything. You don't have to read too many newspapers, too many headlines, to realize that life is not fair. Much of the time, we do not seem to live in a moral universe. Honesty does not always appear to be the best policy. The righteous sometimes go unrewarded. People who are unethical sometimes succeed beyond their wildest dreams and often go unpunished. This is not, however, a new development. 2,000 years ago, the same dynamics were at work in the world. That's why Paul says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked." Do not be deceived. Like us, the ancients recognized that life was not fair, and they wondered what God was doing about it. Well, last Sunday, we read the parable of the prodigal son, which is actually the parable of the prodigal father, the recklessly extravagant father. You remember the story about the younger son who demands his inheritance, his share of the inheritance, and his father gives him half of his property, and off he goes, and he wastes it. And then when the younger son comes back ready to pay, really, for what he did, the father says no, and he welcomes him back as a son, puts the ring on his finger, and throws a party for him. Here we see a picture of a God whose arms are always open, always ready to welcome one of his children home, whose embrace is not dependent on the goodness of our deeds, but rather on the fullness of God's grace. It's a wonderful image when we're envisioning our own path back to our loving Father. But what about when you envision someone like Nicholas Calabrese or Bernie Madoff deciding that, oh, maybe now is the time for me to come home. Suddenly, we're like the older brother in that parable, wondering how any of this is fair. Does it matter what we do? Is character obsolete? Is it worth even trying to be good? Well, Paul offers the beginning of an answer here. Do not be deceived. Things are not all that they seem. There is more to the situation than meets the eye. God will not be mocked, he says. The God who calls us to live lives of honesty and integrity, to treat people with kindness and compassion, does not lower his standards when they're violated. God does not look the other way or pretend not to see. This world is imperfect, though, in a moral sense. There's no doubt about it. You do not necessarily get what you deserve. We sort of want a universe where we get what we deserve, but it's just not always that way. And sometimes we're fortunate it's not that way. If you're fiddling with the car radio, trying to find that station, and suddenly you look up and realize it's been a couple seconds since you had your eye on the road, and if that car in front of you had hit the brakes, you would never have known it, and you would have plowed right into them. You didn't get what you very well deserved by not watching the road. I wonder sometimes how often we're the beneficiaries of little mercies like that, and we don't even recognize it. But back to Paul's point, talking to the people of Galatia who obviously were wondering about this lack of consequences for those who are clearly living only for themselves, or as Paul calls it, living in the flesh. People who are not living according to a higher calling, which Paul calls living in the Spirit. I have to be a little careful about when Paul talks about the flesh and the Spirit. It sounds like the flesh, bodily things, anything to do with the body is bad. The Spirit, that's good. It wasn't quite that simple in Paul. Tom Wright, New Testament scholar, says, you know, flesh and spirit in Paul are opposite of one another, but this isn't the material world versus the non-material world. Many works of the flesh are practiced by the Spirit, like envy or greed or falsehood. Really, when you talk about flesh and the Spirit, it's a matter of where your true identity lies, where your deepest motivations come from, where the power that rules your life is really found. You sow to the flesh, then you're living for yourself, a self-absorbed, self-centered world. Living to the Spirit, for Paul, is living for others, living a life where you are connected to God and connected to other people, living a life of love, really. So God is not mocked, Paul says. We reap what we sow. There are consequences for what we do, and we are accountable for them. Sometimes those consequences are experienced in this world. The parable of the prodigal son, the younger son, he takes all of his half of the inheritance. He squanders it, wastes it, comes back with nothing. And it seems unfair, you know, it seems he's welcomed back as a son. But if you read the parable carefully, you realize that the father says later to his other brother, the elder brother, he says to him, "Son, all that I have is yours." In other words, all that the father has, which is the other half of the inheritance, belongs to the older son. So here in this parable, God is being quite fair to both sons. Nicholas Calabrese, the mob hitman. It seems in some ways he's getting off easy, and which he is. But as in the same newspaper, the columnist John Cass wrote, Calabrese has not lived a day without fear his entire life, his whole life in the mob, and now his life outside the mob. He's always looking behind him, wondering who's going to be coming up, who's going to be out for retribution. He's lived a life of fear all of his days. There are some consequences in this world. Bernie Madoff, perhaps, it's very imperfect justice. He is going to jail, but that isn't going to replace what all those people have lost, what those charities have lost. And there are consequences for all of our actions as well. You know, we've looked a lot at the economy in these last months. We've been watching it go down the tubes. This week in Time magazine, Kurt Anderson sort of chides us a little bit. He says, let's not pretend that we didn't see this coming for a long time. He said, 25 years ago, the average household saved 11% of its income. In 2007, it was less than 1%. He says, the average house is now 50% larger than it was 25 years ago. He writes, it's as though we decided that Mardi Gras and Christmas are so much fun, we ought to make them a year-round way of life. So let's not pretend that we didn't see this coming. He goes on, by the way, to insist that we need to look at the glass as half full in these days, that this crisis that we're in is actually the end of excess, the end of excessive living, and in that, it's going to be a good thing, because he has confidence that we'll find a way to reinvent ourselves yet again. But that's a story for another day. So imperfectly, there are consequences in this world for the bad choices we make, for sin, for the poor decisions, for the things that we do that hurt ourselves or each other or the world. But Paul goes beyond that. He says there are also consequences in the next world. The son of one of the victims of the mobster Calabrese said that he expected the judge would be lenient in his sentence because the judge needed to encourage other members of the mob to also become informers, and so that more convictions could be made and more people put behind bars. So he expected the judge would be lenient, but he said Calabrese won't be receiving his ultimate penalty in this life. If he believes in God, he says, he knows what is coming. He knows what he has coming. The Bible often in the Old Testament says that vengeance is mine, says the Lord, which is a way of saying that God is the ultimate judge, that God is the one who really knows the deeds that we have done, the thoughts that we've had. God is the one who can hold us accountable honestly and fairly and truly, and God will do so. I remember one of the best Easter sermons that I ever heard was not so much about life after death and how Christ rising from the dead gives us hope that our loved ones are alive and that we will live after death. It was beyond that, it said. It said the Easter promise is also that one day the wrongs of this world will be righted. One day justice will be done for the victims of oppression and abuse, for those whose lives have been cut short. The resurrection of Jesus means that there is more, that God will bring comfort to those who have suffered, will bring healing to those who have been wounded, will bring life in the full sense, to those who have been wronged. So how do you balance that, this judging God, but also this welcoming Father? How do you put those together? You have this grace, this wonderful grace we talked about last week with the Father waiting for his son to come home, going out to the mailbox every day, looking down the road. Will this be the day he comes back? And yet also, you have this image of God as the one, as the old prayer says, Almighty God, to whom all hearts are open, to whom all desires are known, from whom no secrets are hid, that God who will really know us and hold us accountable for the choices we've made and the ways we've lived. How do you put those together? I remember once when I was about 12 years old going with my family to visit family friends in another state, and the parents decided they were going to go out to dinner and leave the kids at home. And as the 12-year-old, I was the oldest one, so I was in charge of the six of us kids. And we decided we'd go out and play in the snow, and we started throwing snowballs. And my brother thought, you know, let's throw some snowballs at the neighbor's house, and then we'll duck behind that little snowbank. So he started throwing snowballs at the neighbor's house. And you know, I knew that this was not a good idea. So I, believe me, I did not throw a single snowball at the neighbor's house. truth. So we'd throw, we'd duck, you'd hear the door open. The man would shout out in the snow, "Who's doing that? Stop doing that." And then he'd shut the door, and you know, my brother would get up and he'd throw some more snowballs. Well, about the fourth time, you know what happened. Crash, window breaks. Is it the little window right next to the front door? No, no, it is the huge picture window. Is it a crack? No, it is completely shattered. So not only is this huge, incredibly expensive, I later learned, by the way, window broken, but there's cold air pouring into his house. Snow, of course, it's snowing. Snow is coming into his house. And of course, we have to go over and confess that we're sorry that this happened. And of course, he wants to know where our parents are. Well, they'll be coming home soon. So we went back to our friend's home to wait. And I remember very clearly just waiting for my dad to get home. Now, it's really interesting. I don't remember what happened when my dad got there. I'm sure there were some strong words spoken. I don't remember them. I'm sure there was a punishment handed out. I do not remember what it was. What I remember is waiting for him to be there. What I remember is knowing that I had been the one in charge, that I had been the one responsible, knowing that I had disappointed certainly my father, but also myself. And you know what? It really didn't matter what my dad said and what my dad did when he got home, because I knew the moment was coming that there would be no secrets hid. There would be no deeds unknown. And just knowing it, that was enough. I wonder if that's part of what Judgment Day is. And if maybe that younger son, when he came home to his father who welcomed him home with those loving arms, the younger son really didn't need. He really didn't need his father to tell him anything. Because he already knew. He already knew what he had done and what the consequences of his decision had been. Maybe there's something of that, and that coming together of the Father who waits to welcome us home, but also the one who holds us accountable, or maybe the one who merely turns on the light so that we truly, at one day, whether in this world or the next, we truly hold ourselves accountable for the lives that we live. Paul's writing to people who may be getting discouraged by what they see. He says, "Sow to the Spirit and not the flesh, but don't grow weary about it. Keep it up, because you will reap what you sow. If you sow to the flesh, if you plant seeds for a life that's centered completely around yourself and your own interests and your own desires and your own well-being, in the end, you'll get what you've sown. You'll reap what you sowed. You will have what you wanted, not the life God hopes for us, a life that gives and celebrates and creates and shares joy and love, but a life that's isolated, a life that's fearful, a life that's absent of purpose and genuine connection, a life really without love. Or you sow to the Spirit," Paul says, "and then you get that kind of a life, the kind of a life that creates and shares and blesses and enjoys. So don't grow weary in well-doing," Paul says, because first of all, you want to be able to look in the mirror. You want to be able to look in the mirror and like what you see there, like the person that you have chosen to become. Don't grow weary in well-doing because that's the only life that's worth living, the life that's in service of what really matters, of what matters in this life as well as in the next life, a life of faithfulness and integrity and love. Is virtue out of date? Is character obsolete? Maybe it seems so at times. But those choices we make all the difference in when we look in the mirror or when at the end of our days we expect to find a father waiting to welcome us with open arms, or the father who will be turning on the light. So that we really see the consequences of the choices we've made. And the good news of the gospel is that those, the one who turns on the light and makes us be honest with ourselves, and the Father who welcomes us home, they are one and the same. For the end of the road, as in the beginning, is love. Pray with me. Gracious God, sometimes it's difficult to do what is good. Sometimes it's hard to live right. Sometimes we just get tired. But Lord, help us to see that each and every moment we are indeed sowing seeds, and that we will reap what we have sown. So Lord, let us sow to life. Let us sow to your Spirit. For Christ's sake, for the world's sake, and for our own sakes, we ask it. Amen.